You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As I see Japanese faces looking lost in demolished towns, searching for loved ones, it hurts me too. Slivers of nuclear dust have reached the west coast of North America, and we are already extra jumpy here about earthquakes and tidal waves. We've seen them both, and scientists promise the big one is just waiting to happen. Add in grumpy, broke citizens all across the country paying a lot more at the grocery store and the gas pumps, and well, some of us might need a little counseling. That's why I'm calling up Kathy McMahon, a practicing psychologist who helps people cope with challenging times. Our previous interview remains in the top 10 of Radio EcoShock downloads. Kathy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Kathy, with the new war, video of calamity, a big dose of nuclear fear, the news is a lot to take these days, isn't it?
It sure is. It's pretty scary, and I think it just keeps coming, which is the hard part for a lot of us. We don't quite know what to focus on or what to be concerned about first.
And we don't have time to digest it.
Absolutely.
You know, when I was young in the Los Angeles area, I experienced the earthquake of 1971. There were over 100 killed, the freeway bridges and a hospital collapsed, natural gas lines ripped open and burned for 3 days. I've never forgotten it. I wonder if these big events change us permanently inside.
You know, it's a good question. I think that we never obviously forget when we see horror. It's one of the things that sticks with us. But the thing that reminds me that this is not out of the realm of possibility is that humans have always faced nature, and dead on, and even much closer than we do now. We have a sort of a safe distance that many of us in the West look at nature through, sort of the large picture window that keeps us safe and protected, or at least with that feeling that we're somehow safe and protected. So I think that despite the fact that, yeah, I agree with you that we feel a tremendous amount of horror, we also have this sort of built-in mechanism that helps us to be resilient to accepting that horror is something that happens to humans. And I'm starting to think that maybe modern industrial man might actually be more in shock as a result of it because we've had so little experience in actually facing it. We've been buffered in so many situations, so many of us.
Although we've seen a lot of it in the movies and our media, so that maybe also made us a little buffered.
Well, except that it's one thing to watch it in a movie because at the end, it all sort of pretty much turns out pretty well and we all kind of go home. But, you know, the people in Japan right now, in northern Japan, aren't going home. And they're actually living with the catastrophe all around them. And that face-to-face reaction to that trauma is so much more dramatic than it is just vicariously experiencing it. You know, it has a small effect, but I think certainly being there and watching just the simple scale of it all is much more overwhelming emotionally to us.
Scientific studies show the number of so-called natural disasters, including such things as monster hurricanes, the floods, and the fires, are definitely increasing, and insurance companies agree. Health professional Dr. Paul Epstein, I've just been reading his new book that's coming out. He says we're seeing an epidemic of epidemics. Are we going to trust nature less, and what does that mean for us if that is the case?
Well, trust is an interesting word. And I think, again, that it has to, my opinion is that we, as, you know, Western folks have been used to looking out at nature as kind of an amusement park. And we've been used to believing that we could buffer ourselves from the full effect that nature has on us. And so I think what's happening is that as these catastrophes are increasing in volume, they're affecting more and more of us. And certainly, I know, looking at what's happening in Japan, we think of Japan as such an advanced civilization, and we look around at the pictures that are going on in the island, and we suddenly realize, wait a minute, there's just a little island, and we're all little people. And so I think it does impact us on that level, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've gotten used to thinking of ourselves as kings of the universes or queens of the universe. And I think that disasters like this that really smack us in the face remind us that we, in fact, are pretty helpless in many, many situations over nature. We don't control it. We're just a part of it.
Well, you've kind of answered my next question. I was thinking along the lines of distrust that people don't believe what the government is saying and they don't believe what the media is saying or what corporations say. And I was going to ask, you know, are we modern humans changing fundamentally to a more suspicious or fearful state? But you're calling up an image of primitive humanity where we were perhaps always wary as we walked through the jungle that something might get us.
And we always should have been. Because, again, we were constantly reminded of our interdependence with the world around us and that we could not control everything. In modern life, we have such a conviction that we have control over everything because we do these remarkable things we don't think a moment about. We hit a switch and light comes on and fills the room. We turn a button and suddenly we get heat. I mean, these are just phenomenal accomplishments that we don't even think about, we don't even consider, and we don't assume anymore that we should be cold in the winter or hot in the summer. We don't assume that we should face incredible discomfort and survive through it. So, yeah, I think that modern humans in some ways are more vulnerable than ancient man because of our expectations. And I think what we're seeing now, Alex, is we're having repeated experiences of violated expectations, which are really shocking to so many of us.
Kathy, you and I think community building and transition is the best answer to large-scale troubles, and yet I see in the politics in the United States in particular that there is a breakout of distrust, and it's difficult even to govern in many parts of the world. We're seeing revolutions that people don't want what they have, but they don't know what they do want. So how are we going to do that community building if there is a wave of cynicism and distrust?
Well, the cynicism seems to be on one level. The cynicism seems to be about people who put themselves in positions of authority and superiority over us. I think one of the things, as I was watching Al Jazeera, that I was really excited to hear is that in different countries, in Arabic, they were chanting a very popular slogan that we're all aware of, which is, "The people united will never be defeated." And it was just remarkable for me to hear that, because it's addressing what you're saying, which is that we've had situations for so many years in so many countries where the dictators were of the belief that they could pretty much do whatever they wanted and that people had to be underneath and cooperative with them. And I think what we're seeing, which is very hopeful for me, is that we're seeing people whose commonality is, say, their nationalism, get together and say, you know what, we are not going to settle for threats anymore. You can kill this person and this person and this person, but it's going to bring us more together. It's going to make us more insistent that this can't continue to go on. And so in a lot of ways, you know, the issue of democracy is a very messy issue, and I don't think it gets easier as the countries and the sections that you're trying to control get farther and farther removed from the local level. But I think, again, that we need to begin to think back to earlier times when where we were primarily invested was in how our local communities were run, that we put a lot of effort into the individuals that were taking care of our streets and our neighborhoods and our towns. And we were responsible for those people in our neighborhoods and our towns. And I think the farther you get away from that neighborhood attitude, the farther you get removed from, you know, your local representatives or your local townsfolk to your state representatives and finally on the federal level, the less control that you feel and the more cynicism that people in general begin to feel as a result of that.
And here's another disconnect I'm feeling, and that is that even as the nuclear reactors in Fukushima, Japan, were smoking and threatening to blow up this week, there was a blast of big headlines in Western media saying we must build more nuclear power plants. We have to. There's no danger. The climate requires it. And the more they say that, the less I believe it. So, you know, nuclear power, it frightens people to the bone. And what does it say about leaders and about our media that they won't acknowledge those emotions are real and that they matter?
Yeah, well, I think a long time ago, someone discovered that if you repeat a lie often enough, that you'll get a lot of people to start believing it. And, you know, look at it this way. The nuclear industry, I just was writing on my blog, Peak Oil Blues, the nuclear industry was beginning to experience a renaissance. We were beginning to see in various blogs a description of how nuclear power was good for the environment, and in various spots there was a story about Chernobyl and how it's become sort of like an archaic kind of amusement park now that people are being taken through on tours and that sort of thing and how beautiful it is. So we were going through a shift in the propaganda, which was saying that nuclear power is really okay for the United States. And we began to see Obama beginning to okay the first nuclear power plants in 30 years. And so I think what's happened is that this experience in Japan has so completely shocked the folks that have been watching it go on, and even the Japanese themselves, that I think you have to begin a really big push in the propaganda machine to try and override this fear that people have, which, again, is a fear of an invisible toxin that kills you over time in ways that you can't measure through epidemiological studies, because they have so much to do with how much radiation that you've had in your life previously. So some people in a town who've gotten hit by radiation and who've never really been exposed to very much before might not get sick, or somebody else who's had several doses of radiation over living your life, and it's hard to avoid it, may in fact get sick. So I think when people instinctively feel something is wrong, they then become very suspicious, because they repeatedly hear government one day, like in Japan, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in Japan, saying, we've got it under control, there's no danger to the population, and yet an hour or a day later, we see another situation in which it raises our fear level, and even we have people in power in Japan actually crying on the television, apologizing for the kinds of crises and the catastrophes that are happening. So I think the cynicism and the skepticism is good, is very, very healthy. And I frankly believe that the nuclear industry in the United States anyway has a huge challenge that I severely at this point doubt they'll be able to overcome. Locally in my area, the nuclear power plant that's about 35 miles away from me was going up for review. And it was supposedly good for 40 years. They look at it and they say, oh, it's fine for another 20 years. Well, you know what? I am going to be the first one to take a 35-mile drive to make it clear that, no, I don't want another 20 years of that reactor. And I think a lot of people are going to feel the same way as I do.
Which reactor is that?
It's Pilgrim.
Right. There's some really worrisome old plants up your way in New England. I'm thinking of Vermont Yankee. That's another ancient GE boiling water reactor, just like in Fukushima. And there's Oyster Creek in New Jersey, the nation's oldest. And, of course, there's the Indian Point reactor, another relic with a bad safety record, just 38 short miles north of New York City. You know, I've seen governors are trying to get these things closed and don't seem to be able to. Is there a growing nuclear dissent in New England?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and here's the thing I think that people don't really get, is that it costs as much money to close a nuclear power plant as it does to build one. So the decision to build another nuclear power plant means that you're paying twice. And given the economics that are going on in our area, where are we going to get not only the huge amount of money to close one, but the huge amount of money to build another one simultaneously? So, you know, again, I think all of these issues that we're talking about, we have to sort of circle back to a very important point, which is that we need to be able to recognize that to live without nuclear power means that we're all going to have to power down. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, I want to use all the energy that I'm using now and I don't want to have any other sorts of power, like large-scale nuclear power plants, to take care of my problem. We have to recognize that there is going to be an important interim where we're all going to have to begin to live more simply and cut back on the amount of energy that we're using to date.
And you do that personally. Now, it's only been 5 months since we ran your Peak Oil Blues speech here in Vancouver. It seems like a whole year has passed, but it's only 5 months. What have you been up to?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm excited about is that I'm just finishing up a book that I'm hoping that will be ready for my fifth anniversary of Peak Oil Blues. It's hard for me to believe that I've been running Peak Oil Blues for 5 years, starting in the end of May, but it's been the case. And one of the issues that I've been hearing a lot about is the notion that there are couples where one is really fearful of what's going on about energy and in the environment and the economic troubles that the United States is having, and really all over the world. And the other person is like, well, what's the problem? You know, there's really no issue. I don't want to really disturb my life in the way I'm living it. So I am putting together, finishing up a book called I Can't Believe You Actually Think That, A Couple's Guide to Finding Common Ground About Peak Oil, Climate Catastrophe, and Economic Hard Times. And I'm really excited about it because my take on it is a little bit different than a lot of people. I'm really looking at the idea that we in the peak oil community have to reconsider how we're approaching our spouses and really start to recognize that notions like wanting to get our spouse on board can be pretty insulting, because the implication is, you know, by hook or by crook, we've got to convince them of something that they inherently disagree with. So my approach in the book is a little bit different. You know, my approach is, if you married this person, if you selected them out of, you know, all of the people that you were potentially interested in, why wouldn't you respect them enough to begin to have serious conversations which allow the both of you to begin dialogue? So that's what the book's about, and I'm really excited about it coming out, and I'm offering sort of a sneak preview for folks that are interested in signing up ahead of time.
And what's your website?
It's www.peakoilblues.org/blog.
Kathy, I'd like to talk with you for about another 2 hours about the personal things that we can do, the psychological toolbox to prepare for what are going to be worse headlines to come. But we've run out of time for today. Our guest is Kathy McMahon. She's developed ways to feed our capacity for happiness and cope even in the worst of times. You can listen to our previous radio interview on Kathy's fine speech in Vancouver, Canada, by going to our Peak Oil page and the audio on demand menu right at ecoshock.org, or look for our October 29th, 2010 show in the program archive. Those are all free MP3s waiting for you. Kathy, thank you so much. It always makes me feel better to talk with you.
It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The ongoing nuclear disaster in Japan is one of the most difficult stories I have ever reported on. It is also an earthquake in human affairs, with tentacles reaching out around the world, shaking up energy systems, the global economy, and the way all of us feel. Japan had the third largest economy in the world. Now that is in doubt. The big companies are still closed, corporations like Sony, Honda, and Toyota, with most facilities closed. The largest utility company, Tokyo Electric, or TEPCO, says it cannot provide enough electricity to run former manufacturing due to the loss of nuclear power reactors and damage to infrastructure. TEPCO has asked the government to institute electricity rationing and plans to continue rolling blackouts this summer when air conditioning demands are high in Japan. Many companies overseas were relying on just-in-time critical parts from Japanese companies, some of them shipped by air. For example, a General Motors plant in Louisiana has shut down, saying it cannot get critical parts. That is just the beginning for corporations all over Asia and the world who depend on Japanese exports. Food exports from Japan will also affect global markets and eventually the price you pay at the grocery store. On Tuesday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration banned the import of fruit, vegetables, and dairy products from the four prefectures close to the damaged Daiichi reactors, Fukushima, Ibaraki, Tochigi, and Gunma. The London Telegraph newspaper quotes André-Claude Lacoste, the head of the French Nuclear Safety Authority, saying ground contamination would last for, quote, decades and decades, end quote, with expected contamination in a radius of 60 miles or 100 kilometers. All countries are checking fresh Japanese seafood for radiation. Only two samples of seawater near the plant have been reported, and both are high in radiation. The amount of contaminated seawater passing through the reactors, the spent pools, running off the radioactive debris at the site and right back into the sea is unknown but substantial. This multiple reactor accident in Japan has blown a wave of nuclear fear and criticism in the United States. Briefly, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has demanded the end of the aging Indian Point nuclear plant. He wants it shut down. The big backup system for that reactor failed in August 1999. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission may have to reevaluate the so-called Plume Exposure Pathway Emergency Planning Zone, which is currently set at 10 miles, compared to the 50 miles recommended by U.S. authorities around Fukushima. That could be impossible and may mean some nuclear plants would have to be shut down. See the article by Kate Shepard in the March 22nd post at motherjones.com. In Texas, NRG Energy announced a probable delay of their plans to build two new reactors in South Texas with Japanese nuclear maker Toshiba. Financing is now unlikely, the company says, after the Fukushima disaster. That was reported by the Wall Street Journal. New polls show most Americans now oppose further federal funding for nuclear construction. It's very unpopular, and most people want the private corporations to pay for any accident losses instead of putting that incalculable burden on the taxpayers. The survey was by CSI/OCR, as reported by Mark Clayton of the Christian Science Monitor. Support for nuclear power in the United States has plummeted since the accident in Japan. The International Atomic Energy Agency announced radiation 1,600 times above normal in an area 20 kilometers from the Fukushima Daiichi plant. The Fukushima plant was holding more spent fuel rods than it was ever designed for, at least 4,000 fuel rods. In addition to the six fully stocked fuel ponds right next to each reactor, there is an even larger seventh pond, which is seldom reported. The Japanese originally planned to reprocess this fuel into another burnable form called MOX, but their intermediary and reprocessing facilities have run into long-term problems which have not been resolved. Like every other country, Japan has no place to put its growing nuclear waste. Reuters reported on March 22nd the first detection of radiation from the Fukushima plant in Reykjavik, Iceland. The tiny traces of radioactive iodine had spread from Japan and was expected to arrive also in France the following day. That was measured by stations set up under the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization. Those measurements are supposed to be secret, but results were released by Austria. And that's just what I predicted, that radiation would travel around the northern hemisphere. I had some people write me and say I was wrong, but now we see that it is happening. Thank goodness it's only in small amounts so far, but that depends on whether the Japanese can bring these reactors under control, and that is still an open question, according to the IAEA. Meanwhile, thousands of nuclear refugees are sleeping in arenas and other public buildings after the mass evacuation around Fukushima. For example, 2,300 people from the town of Tishimashi are in the town of Saitama. The first makeshift school for their children was set up this week. Residents fear they will never be allowed to return.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption? To receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal.
little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. Well, that's not enough unless we change. The judgment day is every day. Wars have been fought over who owns what. Lives have been lost and fortunes won. But you and I will someday win. Cause no one owns the wind or sun. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. More power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.
That was Power From Above by New England folk singer Dan Bergson. Thank you, Dan, for all your fine music.
In the wake of the nuclear crisis, protesters hit the streets of downtown Tokyo earlier in the day, demanding that Japan get rid of its nuclear power facilities.
It's okay, they say, for the health, but we think it's very dangerous and very serious, and we are very worrying about it.
Government officials say the entire Fukushima complex will be scrapped once the emergency is resolved.
First of all, the radiation level at the west gate of the plant was 269 microsieverts, while radiation north of the service building was 3,054 microsieverts on March 20th. In American measurements, one sievert is about 100 rem. A chest X-ray is anywhere from 6 to 18 microsieverts. The lowest clearly carcinogenic level is 100 microsieverts per year. So at over 3,000 microsieverts per hour, parts of the Fukushima plant are extremely dangerously radioactive. An investigation by the Wall Street Journal shows the Daiichi plant had more serious incidents than any other large nuclear facility in Japan even before the earthquake. It was aging and the original design had problems. Also, Japan power companies handle reactor spent fuel differently than their American counterparts. When it comes time to service a reactor, U.S. nuclear operators move only some of the still active fuel rods to the spent fuel pool, while keeping most within the much more protected reactor vessel. At Fukushima Daiichi Reactor No. 4, as with most Japanese reactors, all the hot rods were placed at once in the cooling ponds, which have no safe outer containment and depend completely on water pumping to stop a nuclear reaction. The less safe practice contributed to the serious fears about overheating in the spent fuel pool reactors of No. 5 and No. 6, but especially Reactor No. 4. It is called full core discharge, and that practice may have to be re-examined in light of this accident. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Keep tuned to our podcast, subscribe at our main page, ecoshock.org, and listen to our weekly program broadcast on 25 college and community radio stations, plus Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Thank you again for listening.